Hello again. In the seventh and final podcast in the series on world religions, we need to examine the issue of tolerance, rightly understood and wrongly understood. And to do that, I want to begin by talking about a faith that is particularly well suited, I think, to our modern age, and that's Baha'i. I know many of you have heard of it, and perhaps you've even met some Baha'is. I know they have a headquarters, unless they've moved it, in Willamette, Illinois. But it's a religion that actually comes from Persia in the 19th century. The founder was Baha'u'llah. And it's a religion that says, if I can just simplify it a bit, all religions are manifestations of God. God is involved in history. He sends messenger after messenger. And in a sense, if I can simplify it a lot, all roads lead to God. It's an extremely open-minded and tolerant religion. Well, that fits well at a liberal institution like Harvard Divinity School. When I was at Harvard, the years I was there, I had three different roommates. One was studying to be a Lutheran priest. One was a Catholic monk. But I had a year with a Baha'i. And he was hoping to become an official historian of the Baha'i faith. Now, it's a very modern religion, founded in 1863, but that's still a lot of history. At the same time, the Baha'is were being persecuted relentlessly in Iran. And I remember, and this is the early 80s, very early 80s, and also in the 70s, that it seemed like every week the regime was hanging Baha'is. So you have these public executions. And the Baha'i are very peaceful people. But part of their strength, and I think it's a little bit like the strength of Mahatma Gandhi, refusing to be violent, taking a stand, you have leverage, but you can run afoul of the system as well. The Baha'is came from Shiite Islam. They emphasize the spiritual unity of all mankind. And as I mentioned, Baha'u'llah is their founder. And they've been in the United States, by the way, for quite a while as well, but growing fairly slowly. It's a very, I say, open-minded kind of faith, emphasizes tolerance. There are about 6 million Baha'is in the world. Most of them live in Asia, as I mentioned, close to 4 million, but there are a couple million in Africa and even almost a million in Latin America. So probably the largest Baha'i community in the world today is in India, because in Iran, where they've been so persecuted, the numbers are much lower, probably about a third of a million. Well, 6 million, 7 million, a total, something like that. Do they have scriptures? Well, the canonical text, and I'm taking this from the perfect font of all true wisdom, Wikipedia. The canonical texts are the writings of the Bab, that was an earlier leader, Baha'u'llah, Abdul Baha, Shoghri Effendi, and the Universal House of Justice. So you have canonical texts, and then you have the authenticated talks of Abdul Baha, and the writings of the Bab and Baha'u'llah are considered divine revelation. The writings and talks of Abdul Baha and the writings of Shoghi Effendi are authoritative interpretation. And those of the Universal House of Justice are authoritative legislation and elucidation. Did I lose you there? I think I actually lost myself. But you know, every religion has something in writing. The attitude towards that text or group of text may differ from faith to faith, cult to cult, sect to sect. But everyone has something written down. So this is why I think that the Baha'i faith is, in a way, the perfect religion for our age. You know, that God has manifested himself in so many ways throughout the course of human history. And, you know, that kind of open-minded thinking, I think it's wrong. It's very optimistic. It's over-optimistic. But it doesn't fit in very well with a totalitarian regime. For example, Islam in many of its manifestations, or Christianity in the Middle Ages, in what's called Christendom. When Christianity was a state religion, there was really no room for dissent, because in that kind of society, where religion and politics are so closely intertwining, dissent religiously is really no different to sedition politically. To commit treason Now, I mean, no one would think in the United States that, well, if I have a different view about faith, then I'm treasonous and I should be incarcerated or executed. But in a totalitarian regime, that's exactly what can happen. Well, surely tolerance is a positive. Surely we should be tolerant. Okay, I think so. But what does that mean? The truth is, tolerance requires disagreement. Now, that may sound a bit odd to you. I don't think it will in 2 minutes if you hear me out here. If I'm with someone who has the same opinion I do, do I tolerate that person? That wouldn't be the right word, would it? It'd be, I agree. If we both follow the same sports team, you know, it's interesting. In our family, we have many different sports. My wife loves to watch tennis. Our youngest child, who's actually Chinese, loves football. And I mean the world football, soccer. And she likes Manchester United. So do probably hundreds of millions of other people all over the world. Well, if you're a fellow Manchester United fan and you meet my daughter, you won't say, well, I tolerate her, because you already agree with her. Tolerance is for a Manchester United fan to be with a Manchester City fan or Arsenal or Chelsea supporter and not, you know, for things not to become tense. If you're at one end of the political spectrum and someone else is at the opposite end, that requires tolerance. It's more challenging to have a gracious interaction. We don't tolerate people that we agree with. And often I use an analogy from the kitchen. I don't tolerate spinach because the truth is I love spinach. But I have a hard time, I'm not alone, I have a hard time eating Brussels sprouts. And usually if they're served, I'll have one just to be a good sport. But I find them very bitter. That's the way they taste to me. And so you could say that I tolerate them. So tolerance actually requires disagreement. Or in the case of vegetables, something that you find disagrees with you, something that is disagreeable. It's not tolerance if you think the person's right. And this underscores a subtle shift that's been taking place, I think, probably since the time I was a little boy. 50 years ago, tolerance was tolerance of persons. That is, a Christian would tolerate a Jew, a believer would tolerate an unbeliever, or in India, a Hindu would perhaps tolerate a Muslim and vice versa, though thinking back to the creation of the state of India in the 1940s after World War II, and then later the separation of Pakistan, West and East, millions of people died. And so, you know, a lot of us imagine, oh, those people there, they're tolerant in this country, if we could just be like them. And I'm telling you, as a student of history, a lot of times when there's a difference in religion, despite all the talk about tolerance, there's bloodshed. There's genocide. Millions will die. Okay, so maybe I'm bursting one bubble. What about this shift I'm discussing, I'm referring to? Tolerance of persons became tolerance of ideas. Maybe you know someone at work who's from a different religion. Hopefully you show great respect to that person, and it wouldn't stop you from having a meal together and reaching out. But what if I told you, no, it's not good enough to show respect. You have to actually, truly believe in your heart that that person is right. Or, to turn it on its side, you cannot believe that you are right, at least not too much, relatively speaking. That's tolerance of ideas, which is basically saying everyone's equally right or everyone's equally wrong. You might as well say, everyone's wrong, because if we're going to pretend everyone's right, then there's no difference to everyone being wrong. And this is actually nonsensical, because the strong belief that you should tolerate all ideas should certainly include the toleration of ideas that are, by its definition, intolerant. So if you have the Western religions that tend to be exclusive in their claims, Islam believes it's right and the rest of the world is wrong, and one day we'll all become Muslims, or they'll die. I mean, Christianity in that way is intolerant because truth is exclusive by its nature. The Western religions are different to the Eastern religions, which claim to be more broad-minded and open. But the truth is, If someone really is a Hindu, he thinks he's right and he thinks you're wrong. He may say, oh, I'm a Christian, I'm a Hindu, I'm a Muslim, I'm all those things. But he's really saying you're wrong and he's right. And so a lot of this talk is just that. It's just talk. It's just propaganda or rhetoric, depending where it's coming from. Tolerance of ideas is a very dangerous idea. And that's dominating not only liberal religious institutions in our world, but also the courts. And it's a not so subtle shift that's taken place, I suppose, in the last half century. Christianity is exclusive. Because we are saying, if you don't go through Jesus, you're not going to make it. Jesus claimed to be the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one would go to the Father except through him. And this is what people bristle at, particularly those who falsely believe that really all religions are the same. And I think already you're seeing that all religions are not the same. In fact, the differences among the world religions are much greater than the similarities. Let's be honest about that. But Christianity is not only exclusive, it's also inclusive. And again, exclusive means that all the wrong answers are excluded, kind of like in mathematics. 5 plus 5 is 10. Any other answer is wrong. You could say it's narrow. It's a narrow view. Only 10 is correct. What about 9 and 11? Are you going to hurt the feelings of 12 and 13? How about 6.5? I'm sorry. 5 plus 5 makes 10. And so the truth is by its nature exclusive. Then how is Christianity inclusive? Well, it's inclusive in not being discriminating. In the Bible, think of the ministry of Jesus and the apostles. Think of the teachings of the New Testament. Think of that beautiful vision in Revelation 7:9, where that immense multitude gathered from every tribe and language and nation. Everyone is there. Not to say everyone is saved, but those who are saved are from everywhere. Jesus reached out to the highborn and the lowborn, minorities, those who had been excluded from the temple as unclean. No sin disqualified someone from becoming a Christian. In the New Testament, we read about murderers becoming Christians, adulterers, people guilty of heterosexual sin and homosexual sin, deceit, thieves, and people who are too respectable to do those things, but who look down their nose at them and thus are condemned in their own self-righteousness. All of us can make it. And the vision of Christianity is one that's intensely inclusive. And that's what I emphasize when I talk to broad-minded, Western-educated men and women, educated and brought up within all these different world religions we are discussing. I emphasize that Christianity is actually inclusive. We want everyone to make it. No one's excluded. It doesn't depend on your class. It doesn't depend on your gender. One class will not be treated better than another. Favoritism is severely condemned in Scripture. We want everyone to make it. And yet, of course, it's exclusive because we believe that our religion's right. Obviously, if we didn't think that, we would change. We would join your religion, and you would leave yours if you thought yours was wrong. So let's not play games about this. So what are the evangelistic tips, the outreach tips that come from this discussion of Baha'i and tolerance? Well, first, as I've mentioned, all religions are not the same. The differences outweigh the similarities. And I came to understand this during the courses I took at Harvard University's Center for the Study of World Religions. And as I continue to study, oh yeah, there's some commonalities. But I think the commonalities among religions are because people tend to be the same worldwide. But the religions are very different. Different in their view of God and man, what is moral, what is ethical, what our purpose is, how we should relate to our enemies, to outsiders. What do we do to outsiders, to those who don't share our beliefs? Do we try to convert them, or do we kill them? Do we ignore them, or do we pray for them, or do we eat them? I mean, you can find a wide range of positions. All religions are not the same. All roads do not lead to Rome. We need to really rethink what tolerance is. And I challenge you, and if it's unclear in any way, meditate on that shift from tolerance of persons to tolerance of ideas. We're under great pressure to imply that everyone is right. We need to rethink tolerance because our modern age has twisted it. At the same time, We can affirm that there is a general spiritual unity of mankind. I think the Baha'is are partly right. But that's only in the limited sense, or I should say the broadest sense of Acts 17:28. When Paul spoke to the broad-minded Athenians, he quoted their poets, you know, we are his offspring, in him we live and move and have our being, that we're all children of God. We're all God's children. And yet we know biblically there's another sense in which we're children of God. When we take a stand on the gospel, when we're born again as sons and daughters of God, Galatians 3, John 3, and so forth, then we're children of God in a different way. Or we could put it like this. Everyone on the planet has a relationship with God. It may be one of alienation or estrangement. But those who follow Jesus Christ have a saved relationship with God. So we're all God's children, but not in the same way. Again, emphasize that Christianity is inclusive, not just exclusive. It's in fact both. I tell people, because this in the modern age, the exclusivism issue is so big, I tell them, I really wish that the Baha'i vision was right. I really wish, I would love to find out that all roads lead to God. But in life, wishing for something doesn't necessarily make it so. Even if you want it deeply and pray for it, it's a lovely idea. And I hope that the God of all grace will make multitudinous exceptions. I hope I'm wrong. I hope the path is broader than I think it is. But I'm just trying to follow what Jesus said. And Jesus talks about a narrow path, a narrow road in Luke 13 and in Matthew 7. And that's the final tip. I think if we're going to be effective evangelistically, it's not enough just to be respectful and gracious. We need to have conviction. Otherwise, we have nothing to offer. And that leads me to urge us to restudy the doctrine of the narrow road in the Bible, that there are only two roads. And this is the case in Genesis and the Psalms and the Proverbs and in the Gospel. There are just two roads. And it's nonsense to say, well, you must be on the narrow road. But if you're not, that's okay too. I mean, that's nonsense. There are two roads. Do you believe that? Then that's a powerful incentive to take a stand. In the series, we have studied a number of religions. All of this was very introductory. Each of these really deserves multiple classes. If you want to go much deeper, I would invite you to order the AIM DVD series on worldviews. The link is in the notes that come with the podcast. And you will watch about 9 to 10 hours of classes. Or perhaps read the book that my friend Aziz and I have written, Jesus and Islam. Visit the worldview section at the Amazon store, and I give you a link, and there are some great titles there if you want to go deeper. Or if you want a lighter view, you may already have this book, but the book Compelling, chapter 11, is on whether all roads lead to God. I hope this podcast on Baha'i and 21st century tolerance is helpful to you, and I hope that all the podcasts offered something that you can use to have a stronger faith, to be closer to our Lord, and to share what you know with as many as possible in the days that God has given us.